Well, Sunday, while you were speaking,
yes,
I was experiencing the things you were speaking about,
oh,
which was pretty bizarre.
It could be.
Because it was right at the same time.
Everything is. Bam, I know. Yeah.
But one of the things that, I mean, I don't know how to put it exactly. I'm going to say I experienced.
Yeah.
Is not the small self regarding itself, not the human regarding itself as good as dead.
Right.
But the nature of reality regarding itself as not so.
Oh, that's, yeah, shit.
And I was like, oh, because I didn't think, I thought it
ended. You want to step away from that clip as soon as possible.
I thought it ended with the humanity being not so.
No.
But then.
No, it goes.
I was like, oh.
Yeah. It was. The Ulysses moment with the sirens singing.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about it. I remember, I'm like, oh.
Serendipity can, yes, that's right. Well, you're in luck. Anytime you talk about nothing being so, you're likely to have some kind of serendipity because that's the case. You know, someone is bound to stumble into some recognition of it if you're talking about it in, I don't know, in an earnest or friendly, you know, environment. Yeah, that's right. The humanity appears, right, as a bubble. As a waveform, that which, you know, dare I say, cognizes or conceives, perceives, witnesses, it's hard to come up with a reliable word, sees through the waveform of what we call humanity. Yes, sees through the waveform of any of its symptoms, then that can include what we hold to be objects. Of course, that can include what we hold as our so-called anthropomorphized selves as the subject. And, yep.
Yeah.
It's not so.
But it was like two levels.
Yes. At least,
and it was
sure.
Like the first level, I was like okay with, because
you've been there before.
I'm like, yeah, I get this.
Right.
That's cool.
Yeah.
What is humanity anyway? Who cares?
That's
so
right.
It was like desperately something, desperately empty, or desperately.
Sure.
I can't think of a word, but I'll come up with
that. Yeah, well, I mean, and the desperate part is, the desperate part belongs to the, call it cognizing perception, that needs it to be something.
That is actually making the description, or feeling the feelings. And
after the fact.
And yes, and then whatever.
Yeah.
Speaking of it or thinking of
That's
it.
That's right, and... Yeah. And you can observe perhaps how can we say quickly or without delay the objectification of naked perceiving or naked conceiving makes it appear as if something is indeed so or was indeed so. Mm-hmm. And you get so close to it, so intimate that you're like, nope, nothing is so.
Yeah.
Because you've penetrated the habit or reflex of lingering in the outgassing of narrative mind. And you get so intimate that you could say prior to any reliance on narrative mind, and good luck.
Yes.
And even that's,
yeah,
you sure know,
the narrative mind.
Just poetry, too.
Claiming to understand something.
Yeah, yeah. You see, any reflection that you have, and you're, of course, welcome to have every and any reflection that occurs. There's no point in rejecting anything at all. But any reflection that occurs is always going to be an outgassing, an aftermath.
Okay, so then let's say...
And that's where the desperate comes
right,
in.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is a question. I'm going to say experience, and to understand, I don't know how to put it, that it is so completely and utterly empty.
Yeah.
It was like, how would you describe coming to see that? Let's call it coming to see that.
Good luck. I mean, that's why Rumi went crazy. You know, he resorted to overzealous Sufi devotionalism because he was stuck too. Then people, of course, they get enthralled by the demonstration of the devotionalism, and then turn that into, you know, the religious or spiritual destination. And it's not. It has nothing to do with it at all. It's just, I don't know what to say, and I'm Rumi, so I'm going to wax on, you know, philosophic about my relationship with God, because frankly, I'm flummoxed. Mm-hmm. And they didn't call him Rumi the flummoxed. You know, we'd all probably be better off if they had. I mean, it's not dissimilar from the Vedanta Society. These many years after the birth, life, and death passing of Sri Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, Sharada Devi, etc., etc., you know, and the icons of that triumvirate, were enthralled by, understandably so, Ramakrishna's, samadhis and ecstasies and penetration of both orthodox Vedanta and non-dual Vedanta. But then that became the basis of the religion. And you're like, no, 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 no. That was just, you know, that was just the poetry of the day through a certain, call it, you know, being that had a very bizarre, you know, karma. But if you turn the demonstration into the religion or the destination of the spirituality, you've missed the point entirely, because the non-destination is the revelation that nothing's really ever happened at all to anybody. And that's what...
And that can't be communicated at all.
I mean, it's all that there is,
right.
But it's also difficult to bring it into... You know, focused vernacular.
I think it might be impossible.
Well,
because a word
is impossible.
You might say a word is a thing.
Yeah.
And if there is no thing.
That's right. That's right.
It's almost like pointing to the door that's a void on the other side.
Yeah.
But you can't really say anything about what's on the other side, but you can.
You can't really, but it doesn't stop anyone, nor need it. Yeah, but you see what we call the fetishizing, spiritualizing, divinizing, sacredizing mind focuses on the wrong thing to turn into the religion.
That is inevitable.
It is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely inevitable. That's right.
We're boxed in.
Totally boxed in.
Nothing available.
But that's why you have, a Buddhist Sangha to throw out a Buddhist.
Yeah.
Because they're boxed in to Nama Rupa, name and form. They're not really interested, dare I say, in the simplicity of liberated understanding.
The desolation of everything.
Yeah, That's right. Decimation of everything.
It's like torching your parching.
At no risk. It is the decimation of everything at no risk to anything. Mm-hmm. You know, go figure.
Yeah.
Now, you know, and then let's say the physicist or the scientist, the sociologist, the anthropologist, you know, whomever, the multiculturalist would want to say that such an insight, you know, is a trick of the brain, a trick of the neurons.
Okay.
And you know, like, no, no, no. You can't reduce it to being a right trick of the neuronal system, of the biological system of what we refer to as consciousness. And how do you know that? Can't say. you can't say. You cannot say with what, let's just say, curious authority one penetrates the right vibratory illusion of present experience and sees that there's nothing and nobody there. You can't vet that authority. Your master can't, you know, give you a certificate. Even if you were certified by some other half-baked Buddhist to be able to speak to other half-baked Buddhists, it doesn't amount to anything.
And it becomes, the tables are turned, because those who would say that you have lost your mind,
they would be correct.
They are nothing but lies. Everything they spout.
That's right.
It's complete lies.
That's right. And yet you're the one that's going to go to jail.
They're like, you're crazy.
They would be correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, you know, maybe that's why so many aspiring or ardent seekers flock to the SAND conference. You know, in hopes of reaching some kind of consensus, some kind of community, some kind of so-called shared understanding. But as you can see, it can't be shared. Mm. You're on your own.
Mm.
And you can speak, dance, you know, use the arts and sciences to express the curious insights that may have come your way, but still you're on your own. You know, nothing being nothing, like Billy Preston said, nothing from nothing leads nothing. Yeah. Right? He should have ended the song right there. Or the next part of the chorus was, you got to have something if you want to be with me. You're like, see you, Bill. I'm fresh out. Well, so that's that. Yeah. That's the bottom line of it, really. And how that insight plays with you and you play with it, how it informs someone, anyone, that's a mystery. That it's in plain sight, like right about here, right about now, and yet so perfectly and profoundly self-obscuring, is to those that get a chance to see it, it's a joy. It's a paradoxical joy. To others that, you know, don't see it or aren't interested in seeing it, well, you know, you're just a lockup.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Were the so-called civilization to be inspired by that depth of insight, who knows what it might look like? I mean, the Buddhists haven't worked it out. The Christians haven't worked it out. The Jews haven't worked it out. The Muslims haven't worked it out. The oligarchs haven't worked it out. Rupert Spira hasn't worked it out. Nobody's worked it out. the collapse of acquisitive consciousness is outrageous. And it so has nothing to do with one's behavior or vows or religious loyalties or renunciation or lack thereof. It's laughable how much absolute nonsense passes as spiritual or, you know, religious iconization, and it all means nothing. That's the, you know, I would say that's the thrill and the challenge of the Dharma, right, moving to the West. Because the Asian Dharma is steeped in ceremonial constipation. The Indian Dharma is steeped in ceremonial constipation. And so are the three principal, right, Judeo-Christian Islamic dharmas as well.
Steeped in what? I forgot that fist.
Yeah, well, orthodoxy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I heard it though.
We had a bat in here once. We had a mouse. All kinds of creatures find their way in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now they're going to take away the stove. Put a big refrigerator there.
Oh.
Inspector.
Uh-huh.
Said, do this, don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Thought I'd forewarn you, the void is coming.
Pulling out the stove.
You can't avoid the void. It will get filled again. And again.
Yeah, you cannot avoid the void. Ryan Crawford texted and said the door is locked.
Mm. Got it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for volunteering.
I thought it was open. It was wide.
I usually, you know, hit the button so that it remains open, so. I don't know. Is there a timer on that light downstairs? Because the motion detector's not coming on.
Inside, if you press the square, it'll activate it.
All right. Would you mind taking a look at that at your leisure?
Yeah.
No. It's not necessary. Because when I walk in, I'm like, oh, okay. Let's see. Hi, John. Don't be shy about writing stuff. Nobody's here but us. We did. We thought you were a bat or a mouse. Yeah, we heard you throwing. We did hear them.
It was a bat.
Oh.
I didn't realize you had to leave it ajar.
You shouldn't have to. If the buttons go right, the lock should remain on.
It was just like sort of spinning, like what weird clicking was.
Ah, yeah.
You could have come in the back door.
I didn't know it was open.
Was there a song? It won't be next time. When you just say, oh, back door.
Yeah, door.
Yeah.
And we'll just wait.
That's for all the spiders. And,
you know, like crap in there.
In the darkest dark back there.
The portal to nowhere.
You know, many people, whether in their, call it home religion, you know, or an adopted one, tend to be comfortable following some kind of liturgy, some kind of routine.
Which would be fine as long as they understand that it doesn't have any actual meaning. Participating is fine.
Yes, and it's hard to say how many of them, us, understand anything about anything, including whether ritualized participation has any meaning or not, right? They're that's where they flock to. You know, the crazy wisdom side of the coin, the more improvisational discovery of the texture of consciousness. Well, for some of us, it's, you know, thrilling and nourishing. And for others, it's like, I don't know how to relate to that. And I don't want to go anywhere near that. It's threatening to me. It's not healing when my bias is it's profoundly healing. I was like, okay, fine. You know, and so, yeah, that's just that. I mean, the ritualizing of, well, human camaraderie, community, recovery, inquiry, discovery. Well, it's a false sense of security. But let's say most folks are happy enough having a place to go or many places to go in their adult lives for community and recovery and spirituality, and they wouldn't know how to participate constructively in an improvisational approach. I mean, we still light a few candles, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Candles are warming. They're not threatening. The, you could say the reflex is consciousness finds itself fascinating. Why not? Why shouldn't it? And you could say in that matrix, in that maze or labyrinth, it anthropomorphizes. The you know, the art of the yoga is that same fascination is still present. Curiosity, fascination, novelty, wonder, awe, devotion, all absolutely present without the reflex to anthropomorphize. Yeah. And that's delicious. Once you become comfortable with it and learn how to linger in it, free from the reflex of taking yourself or present experience prisoner. And therefore free of reasoning, conclusion, and implication.
You know Robert Reich?
Robert Reich, yes.
Yeah, he wrote that book, Why Buddhism is True. Where he takes like the bare bones and sort of compares it to the, what they found in evolutionary psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, he was just on Sam Harris's podcast.
How'd that go?
That was very interesting. We talked for a while about this and that. But then, like, Gary Weber came up, and, like, they both seemed to be like, well, at least Robert Reich did seem to be pretty taken with him. And
was or was not?
Was.
Yeah. Was taken with Gary Weber.
He was one of the guys who did that meditation study. Like, went in and gave them, it was an MRI, or I don't know, whatever, some tests, and when they're meditating this and that. He said, like, the one person that stood out to me was Gary Weber, because everyone else was able to, like, shut off their DMN, the default mode network, after meditating. He said, Gary Weber was, like, in that state all the time, before meditating, after, like,
mm-hmm.
claim like me walking around in a counseling. It was pretty interesting to have.
That's the claim Gary Whipper makes.
Seems to have been backed by them in the hospital. But
there you go. Well, then he's been vetted by the pros.
I don't know what not having your default mode network activated gets you, but I don't know, he claims it's pretty good, I guess, really. But.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You ever met Robert Wright?
I don't think so.
No. You met Gary, right?
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. For some, the default mode network and the other metaphors that Gary strings together rather elegantly, that's a useful, you know, map for seeing the nature of metaphorical mind. The trouble that it causes, and engaging in whatever body of practices to be as successful as Gary is, you know, with the cessation of the default mode network and being totally sanguine and cool all throughout the day. Yeah. He wasn't my cup of tea. There was something about Gary's, you know, nerd science and narcissism, which was a little off-putting. But I'm sure he has a bunch of, you know, happy, friendly, devoted students of one kind or other that are hot on the tail of liberated understanding, whatever that might be. Yeah. So I guess Robert and Sam are, I don't know, secretly envious of Gary's condition?
Yeah, not like secretly, like, you know. They would like that, I guess.
Okay, so they're openly admiring.
Does it imply a greater awareness or something?
It could.
A greater awakening?
Well, it just seemed like whatever state
it could.
They had both talked about getting into during, like, weeks or months of meditation that he walked around in all the time. Mm. I thought, it seems like that's a much less stressful way to live.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
I'm not sure if they thought that was the ultimate end and that was enlightenment. I don't know.
Yeah.
But maybe the way they were talking, no, they weren't like very, they didn't like pin anything down that specifically, but it seemed like that, what they talking about, that seemed like the end all be all, you know.
Yeah.
No center. Just walking around. And
yes.
All the time.
Well, yeah, you see, yes, the, yeah, you, you know, you reduce a thing to a thing, right? An MRI or whatever brain scan readout to as a thing, as a state. Yeah, but it's anything but. You know, streaming novelty, effulgent novelty, is not a state. More subtle than that, you could say, you know, it's a sensitivity. Maybe you could say it's an observation. But then subtler than that, it's what? Then subtler than that, you know, we could use, frame it the way we were talking earlier, you know, emptiness, acausal, nothing is happening prior to the fuming of the narrative mind.
If the Big Bang is the thoughts and the colors and the manifestation of everything, it's prior to.
Yeah, again, that's, yeah, like,
There's no manifestation.
That's right. I mean, I'm happy hearing it. Again, you can't convince anyone with what confidence or authority you say that. And yet,
you know what? I wouldn't
care. And that's right, and you don't care. I don't care. That's right. You're like, hey, I hear you. No, I don't have any authority, and I don't have no confidence, and no one could possibly verify or certify me in anything besides being insane, and I got nothing.
I definitely wouldn't even speak of it outside of here.
That's
because people are just, they'll just drop their jaw. No. What?
Well, that would be a lighthearted reply. The dropping of the jaw.
Right, or they'll say, okay, sure. And,
Yes, that's right. You know, the remarkable confidence game of consciousness pretending to be other than itself, and therefore occupying time and space as an anthropomorphizable being, occurs so quickly and with such a fury, you know.
I just got dragged into that, you know, just by saying that.
Yes, sure. Yeah. Dragged in.
I got dragged into who do I think I'm even talking to?
Yeah. Dragged in without being dragged in. Yeah. I mean, to the extent that one starts to, let's say, reside or abide in novelty, whether through the metaphor of the default mode network or whatever the metaphor is, you're the village idiot. Everyone else has got something going on.
The fool on the hill.
And you're the fool on the hill. Yeah. Yeah.
I've got some more machinations, shall I?
Sure.
Bother you with them?
Well, I
mean, you know,
floor is open. It's as much yours as anybody's.
I don't even know what it was, so. But it's something to do with
yes.
What appears. Yeah, I don't know. But it'll come back to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if language can't express, it's impossible to be expressed and quantified, pinned down, and all that?
Absolutely, yeah.
But at the same time, wherever you look,
mm-hmm. There it is.
Wherever you hear,
yeah.
It's totally surrounded.
Yes, it's perfectly this, and then, and good luck reducing it to, you know, metaphor.
Yeah, because that, I guess, requires thought.
Well, yes, some magical power of reference, yeah. Right?
And that it just won't work?
No, it doesn't. But in some sense, it works just fine.
Mm-hmm. Constantly.
Yes.
It, or whatever.
Yeah.
That's all there is.
That's right. It works just fine.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, feel this or look at it or, let's say, discuss it for fun. Well, non-conflictual paradox. So, yeah, it doesn't work. OK, could never work, works just fine all the time. And I don't have a problem with it. Right, if one is leaning in one or other direction of fixity, whether it's secular fixity or so-called spiritual fixity, or this is the reason, or that's the reason, or this is the explanation, or this is the discipline, well, you know, yeah, you're just blowing smoke up your ass. Because you're bound, once again, to metaphoric codependency. Whereas streaming novelty is not bound. We don't notice the inherent bias of the witnessing. So here's present experience. And what's the bias that anyone brings to, let's use the word, the witnessing of present experience? Well, is it, you know, middle-class white guy living in Republican heaven, speaking at the local hippie church, you know, with the sweet smell of baby poop wafting up from the nursery? That's a bias, right? Maybe it's a molecular bias. Maybe it's a sub-biologic bias. Maybe you feel this through the spleen or through, you know, the gout in your big toe. What's the bias through which we are engaging or interfacing with streaming novelty and then taking a position, whether it's a day trade, you know, or an anthropomorphization?
I'd love to be able to answer that question.
I know. You can't. Just even considering the texture and boundary field of the bias that one brings to present experience is a total mystery. And yet, you know, fixity, no matter what kind it is, any kind of fundamentalism, is, you could say, an unconscious, perhaps belligerent, loyalty to one or several biases through which experience of and engagement with present experience is, right, felt or insisted upon. We don't even care to discover most of the time what our so-called present bias is. We're just drowning in, you know, the implication imagined of what we think present experience is through the more or less unconscious biases that we're bringing to the table with which to perceive, conceive, or remark upon it. And you're like, I don't have any bias anymore. You know, maybe that's what Gary is saying with the default mode network, is that he doesn't have any bias any longer. He articulates it as, I have no thoughts, which is, you know, maybe true, maybe untrue. It's a curious presentation. It might be, I don't know, a little more juicy, from my bias, if making the proclamation of having no thoughts were replaced with, I have no bias. And so the stress reactions that we have through convoluted psychiatric, psycho-emotional, psycho-sensual, psychosomatic relationship with present experience creates the various stress factors, the thousand and one cuts, the betrayals, the disappointments, the fear of malnourishment.
I mean, if he walks around with the DMN shut off, then any thoughts that come up, they're not his. He has no thoughts. They're just appearing.
Yeah, okay, well, sure. True. Technically true, that's right. Yeah, you can't really call him a liar. That's right. Technically true. Yes. Even if thought, what we refer to as thought, arises.
They're not his.
They're not his. So, yeah, he has no thoughts. Gary Weber, 1. Night Sky Sangha, 0. Or the other way around.
That is, oh, geez. See? Now I'm playing, oh, I thought it, I got something to say now.
Sure.
But it's equanimity is what, not have a bias is equanimity, I think.
Yes, those could be.
But I'm not proud of myself for connecting those dots.
Ah, right.
I'm
that's
like,
right.
Oh, you shithead.
Right.
You know?
You know, the horse named Pride is always ready to leave the gate. Yeah, and the marvelous capacity to discover a metaphor, insightful, humorous, paradoxical, what have you. Well, you know, it likes to be heard. It likes to be spoken. It likes its, time in the sun.
I think it wants to give it, I think it's trying to, it wants to claim so that it has substance, you might say.
Yes, it could be
I'm
that.
I'm here.
Yes, but you could I suggest one could also, let's say, engage for fun and profit in sport thinking. Sport metaphor, playful conversation, without a strong sense of claim.
Okay. I believe that maybe sometimes I can quote unquote experience it, and other times,
I hear you.
You know.
Well, good for you. You're multivalent.
Solid.
Yes.
You know, sometimes.
Sure.
Too often.
Okay. Value judgment accepted.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
No. Yeah, because any evaluation that you bring to the table of how well or poorly or moderately or whatever you've been or done prior to now is really just, you know, the thrill of having a value proposition right now. It can't actually bind your present or prior experience. That's frozen specificity. That's how injury, whether casual or more formidable, gets frozen in the psyche. Because we tend to insist that whatever we're imagining now is, you know, a legitimate report about my present and prior experience. And it's not. But to the extent that I insist that my present feelings, present thoughts, story, whether I've told it a million times or just 5 times, is binding, well, that's frozen specificity. That's fixity. And you could say that's the, not that it's a mechanism, but it's kind of a means by which the pride of self, whether that's an accomplished self or an injured self, right, keeps repeating. Present experience actually affords one unconditioned novelty. Are you in? Right? Or do I defer or avoid or postpone because I'm the product of things that I think.
Well, for me, to specifically answer that question, I'm a product of the things that I think. I become that product when I, you know, come up with my
do you?
Goofy theories.
Do you?
Well, in my quote-unquote mind.
Well, you see, in the thinking about the thinking you do.
Yes.
Right. But
I don't actually.
That's right. You can't. Mm-hmm. In the thinking about the thinking, you can turn yourself into anybody.
So it just feels different.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had to make, mm-hmm. if you held a gun to my throat or a knife to my throat, you know, or insisted on a qualitative conclusion of some kind, you would go, it feels different.
It feels small. As opposed to
okay.
expansive.
Right? Yes.
If I come up with something, that's all I have.
If yeah.
I'm presenting my opinion, then that's all I have.
Well, it would like you to believe that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I would say then that's all I see.
Or that's the bias that one brings to this table in self-reflection, self-evaluation, and, you know, then call it sharing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is, again, a curious loop of association. That while it may seem be perfectly plausible, isn't really, really, really true.
I don't want to, like, take up all the conversation.
No one seems to be needing to speak.
The act of, so if I am to put forth something that I have come to understand.
Yes.
Then I am at that same time claiming to have found something that's true.
It could certainly feel that way and be heard that way.
And being says it's not true.
Yes.
It has. It's sort of like an entire different direction. It's like going in two different directions.
Yes, it can appear to be. And for fun. As an experiment, with all that spoken, does not have to interfere with or veer one's attention away from present unconditioned ecstasy. Even in the midst of having an idea, positing an observation, coming up with a value proposition, drawing attention to one's self, you know. But nothing really interferes.
Well, so, I mean, I agree with you, but I don't experience it that way.
You like
I
anyone.
Experience it as a single occurrence.
I would say the reason you experience it as a single occurrence is because that way of framing it is more familiar to you than the okay. concomitant way of framing it, which is, I just don't know. We're framing the unframable, you know, for fun, for friendship, frolic. But nothing anyone says about themselves, does anyone take very seriously or for granted? it's just a present, you know, it's just a present poem. It's just a present bubble that has a certain shape and a certain color and a certain swirl and just goes. See, how does mind convince itself of its own disappointment and sorrow or pride of accomplishment? It does so through, you know, this kind of movement of affirmation. It affirms that which it thinks, that which it feels, the language that's used, the bias that it presumes to be having or not having, and then the manner of expression, which is a form of accusation, and then, you know, accusation and sharing. And you're like, that's cool. I mean, accuse away. Self-accuse and share. Self-accuse and share. Tell us all about yourself. You know? It's like, I got nothing. Granted, pulling up anchor means, you know, you're at the mercy of the wind once again. Mm-hmm. And perhaps our habit is that I don't want to pull up anchor. I want to make sure it's buried deeply and snugly in the sand.
Floundering in open air is threatening.
Yes.
No place to stand, nowhere to fall.
Yes.
It's threatening.
It is. It is a little bit threatening to the reflex of anchoring. It is. That's why in some environments, having a liturgy and a routine and, you know, certain voices that pretend to be representing authority keep the community safe from pulling up anchor. And here, you know, ours is like, hoist up the sail, pull anchor, and, you know, see what kind of horse shit you end up in. You throw the sextant overboard. Follow the North Star until it takes you to a glacial wall at the end of the flat earth. Revelation, you know, streaming novelty is obliterating. In some cases, that, you know, obliteration, again, as a metaphor, looks a little sloppy. And sometimes it's just, you know, a couple of geese overhead. No biggie. Do we need something to be something? Do we want something to be something? Do we insist on a different condition than the one that we imagine ourselves to be in? Is there anyone to blame? Is there anyone to supplicate? How many goats and virgins, you know, do I have to push off the cliff or give to my neighbors, whatever the weird cultural thing is, so that I can, you know, be recognized by the king? How many austerities, how many japa, mala, right? How many prostrations do I have to do? You're like, oh, I don't know, man. Keep up the good work. You know, we're just like, yeah, we're just chilling. The mind, what we call mind, can't do anything other than fetishize. That doesn't make it bad or good. It's just like, oh, wow. Yeah, metaphor, anecdote, memory, story, symbols, language, sentiment, physicality, it's just like, it's just streaming fetish. Seeing it, you know, with an open aperture, if you want to call that heart, spleen, pancreas, adrenals, I don't care. Open pineal, open pituitary, open thymus, far out. Okay. Decalcify. Go talk to the Pleiadians and decalcify your pineal gland so that you can see this with a more open aperture. Then you can see that all that's appearing in and as experience is just both streaming novelty and then the fetish that you bring to the table. And you're like,
and
fuck.
I'm coming up with another thought.
You're not alone. Unless Gary were here, then you'd be alone.
Because I'm not considering this as a streaming novelty is the problem.
That's right. That's right. Because you're
everything
an ego.
Everything else is a streaming novelty.
Because you're an egomaniac.
Yeah. Like, I'm like, okay, this is a streaming novelty, but I
yes
keep getting trapped into thinking this is not.
That's
this
right.
Something else.
Yep. Yeah. You fool.
Oh, always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. I'm done now.
Okay. All right then.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of quiescence that we might be referring to is not the product of surrender. It's just dumbfoundedness. There's nothing to surrender and no one to surrender a thing. As the aperture opens and the revelation of metaphor is seen in its entirety, holographically, holodynamically, you know, stretching the familiar perimeters of time, space, then in a sense everything is surrendered. Everything is forgiven. But not necessarily with, you know, from a sentimental point of view, but the intimacy with emptiness surrenders everything, forgives everything, obliterates everything without fanfare, without, you know, ecstatic reference.
And like without a recipe.
No recipe. That's right. There's nothing fulfilled. We don't really know what happened to Scrooge after, you know, midday Christmas Day, because the story ended. So it's hard to know whether he was that much fun on Christmas morning for the remainder of the day or the remainder of his life. One would hope so, but we're not quite sure. And maybe he was forever changed by the ghosts of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future. But he was a lot more chill about it come New Year's. He had his glorious ecstasy for, you know, a good long week. And after that, he, you know, smoked a pipe and hung out in a very cheerful and endearing way with whomever was in his company. Or he could have gone back to being a self-suffering asshole. I don't want to ruin his, you know, possibilities. I mean, hell, if you wake up on Christmas morning after a night like that, yeah, you got to tell everybody. Everyone gets a turkey. You know, there's just so much love pouring into your soul from the decades of oppression that, yeah, you should just be splurging all over the place. But that could be tiring after a while. You know, you just want to kick back and have a cup of coffee and, you know, be helpful where you can be. Look, you can't give this away. You can sell it. But what's sold largely becomes a, you know, cash in exchange for further hallucination.
And that's all there is to be had.
Yeah.
To be had.
Yes, to be had. Right. You know, as it catches up with you in the way that it will, in the way that it does, you know, maybe you don't mind so much going hungry. You know, there's a certain pathos that is, you know, missed, let's say, in the overabundance of the West, suit of wealth and power and exploitation and avoiding accountability. That becomes a kind of a poison. And just being completely undefended and let the wind and the sirens and the rocks blow you where they will, that's a different game. the fruit of purification. Used to see that there was nothing and no one ever requiring any purification. The constellation of being oneself, a person with whatever, you know, injuries and natural skills, karmic circumstances and consequences, opportunities or lack thereof. You know, it's a formidable and fierce presentation. See ya. I can just drop it. I don't think I put an envelope down. Bye. One hopes to find a remedy for oneself. And that's not how this works. You don't find a remedy for yourself. I'm not sure there is one. The engine of personification that collapses or treats you to occasional abeyance. It's the hunger for remedy, whether circumstantial, evidentiary, psychosomatic, emotional, you know, neuro-linguistically programmed, tapped, EMDR'd, whatever. It's the craving and pursuit of remedy which continues to obscure the myth of the arising of self in the first place.
Ironic. So Ram Dass, you know, fierce grace.
Yes.
Having a stroke, saying this wasn't part of his plan.
Yeah, that's right.
Yet he realized he went for much deeper, because it's like the self-investment is, it's so subtle sometimes.
Yes.
Even if you are, you know, questing like he was, and then something happens, and you're less functional instead of more functional. So deeper questions, I guess. A deeper way of orienting, not so much around the self, but perhaps as much. Like, well, this... That's what this does. It does whatever it does.
Sure does whatever it does.
It can interrupt
your flow.
And you name it. and the interruption can be a blessing if it's not seen as an interruption to what you thought was really important. Wow.
Yeah.
So in that state of, you know, residing, it's sit with my, you know, the things that are sticky for me. It's like, you know, I can do this, not on my terms.
Yeah.
I can trade in my playbook for a blank canvas that's written on. It gets written on in a way, and then gets cleared.
Well, that's you know, for argument's sake, we could point to that as what's actually so, with or without our permission, with our, let's say, permission or kind agreement. Different waveforms, right, come into view, which don't necessarily have to resolve anything that appears to be appearing in the appearance of your life. You know, we tend to picture ourselves as a constellation of circumstances and events and sentiments and beliefs and you know, how we roll, what we're made of. Entertain scenarios, pleasant or unpleasant. And that movement of association is occurring completely metaphorically, etherically, which is what we were referring to earlier as bias. The constellation of self is a portrait of bias, of anticipation and projection, presumption, which is charming in, you know, most cases. But that it's binding, I beg to differ. And the mindfulness practice, however it may be practiced or taught, attuning or attenuating to so-called presence, can help to relieve one or unbind one, us, me, I, from the presumption of being the product of anything. So if it turns out perhaps that present experience is acausal, you might stumble upon, one might stumble upon unbinding. And, you know, the Buddha certainly recommended it. I think, you know, Ram Dass, when he gets around to it, would recommend it too. I think, you know, for my money, he remained, even after his stroke, much too fond of himself. And his eloquent soliloquy. He was always seemed to be distracted by mirthful, if not, you know, New Age-ish implication. I only, you know, have the privilege of enjoying his company once or twice, maybe, at some kind of, you know, workshoppy thing. And like Shania Twain says, that don't impress me much.
I guess it can be really seductive when a name recognition brings in steady income, you know?
Yeah.
And all you have to do is show up, you know, write a book.
Yeah. Brand recognition.
Say something, even if it takes a lot longer to say it.
Jesus, Deepak Chopra died 30 years ago and no one realized it.
I was never drawn to him. It seemed like it was already said so many times the same way.
The Deepak Chopra Sam Harris debate is still one of the funniest things ever.
Is that right? The two of them together, you mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Stage together, it's really funny.
On stage together?
Yeah, having a formal debate.
How'd that go?
I'm not sure everybody thought that the guy they were rooting for won, but, I mean, that Chopra just looked like a fool. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
A typical, like, New Age snake oil salesman.
Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
Sam has his roots dug a little deeper, I think. than Deepak.
Less.
That's an unknown name for me.
Interested in
Harris?
Yeah.
Yeah, less interested in whatever the dogma and all the various claims about unprovable things and this and that.
Yes, that's right. You start throwing out Sanskrit terminology and things like that, and you know, you basically become just a science fictionist.
Yeah, and consciousness was there before the Big Bang, and it created the Big Bang, and does all these things.
I don't have any reason to disagree with it, but look, so what?
Maybe it was, but well, I don't think Chopra has any proof of that.
So. No one could. You know, even Deepak Chopra would have to come up empty-handed when it comes to having proof of anything.
Isn't it like going to a buffet to eat, you know, and
you
pick certain things that you really like. And
The coconut and shrimp.
The mind grabs certain things and is tickled by various contemplations and ruminations and whatnot.
Is Suzanne in the chat? Is she angry or making fun of Chopra?
No one is writing anything.
Just a bunch of Z's, right?
There's a few people that appear to be viewing, but cooking dinner or drinking wine, and this is on mute. Yeah.
Yeah, Harrison Wright did talk about fondly about meditation retreats, and I'm gonna put that idea in my head again. Yeah,
To do a lengthy sit.
Yeah, it'll be a while if I get around to it, maybe next summer, but something like a nice idea.
Oh, they're a lot of fun. They really are. Yeah, doing, you know, many hours of sitting and walking practice and getting into that strange rhythm of discarding your life. I mean, you know, you can't bring your phone with you. I mean, you can, of course. But
you're much accomplished.
You really, treat yourself and leave your electronics and things, you know, behind. Ask the office to lock them up, so that you can, you know, go through the bake.
Yeah, it was funny. Harris talked about going, and there was like the one like 10-minute interview a day, and you could hear the guy before you because you were just in line waiting. And he remembers like this, like 1 month, and the guy saying, "Oh yeah, I was able to follow my breath for 5 minutes, and everything's going well." And then like 2 weeks later, he was like, "I think I got 5 breaths consecutively today." Like,
yeah, 5, right.
It was like, not that this guy was, like, his abilities were degrading, but just that after he began to actually pay attention, he began to notice that, like, he just was lost in thought, like, 99.99% of the time.
Basically insane.
Aware that you're aware.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
daunting, right?
The value of those long meditation retreats doesn't necessarily get you any closer to realization, contrary to popular belief. What they're useful for is to, in a sense, be a captive audience to just how insane you are. It's humbling. I am so restless. I had no idea.
Yeah.
You're like, dude, that's right.
I can focus for 5 seconds at a time.
And even the focusing thing is, that's a rudimentary, part of the craft. The notion of harnessing and cultivating focus. I like, I'm personally more fond of, just open attention. And even open attention is not necessary for it to be resilient. Really, who cares? You know, to see the arising of inhabitation and self-interest, that's enough. Because that is the genesis of bias. And the imagination of one's life and one's way of being floods in. And then there's either like or dislike, or both, or neither, according to the streaming nature of bias and association and metaphor and story narrative that comes pouring in, when we are, let's just say, somewhat undistracted. That's Mara. You're having a, you know, front row, private audience with the master, the king of distraction and association. It's riveting, man. And of course, we want to negotiate. We want to transcend. We want to resolve, come to closure, you know, figure out what we can and should do about the arising of ourselves. And that's how it, right, continues to enroll the, call it quality of awareness, into self-designation. Yeah. What is present experience at all if it's not enrolling you in some kind of objectification, some kind of narrative? And can we discover the capacity to be nourished in the face of it? The alchemy of present experience is blown wide open all the time. And the purification rituals that we might participate in they're all useful. The cessation of becoming catches up with you despite your best or worst intentions. It's a, you know, form of agony. To relate to living present experience, right? Through the bias of being someone, something, right? With a past and a present and a future, and conditioned and full of expectation, avoidance, manipulation, supplication, right? The crystal ball of time. It's agony to which we habituate, you know, sometimes gracefully, sometimes not so gracefully. what does it feel like if I'm without argument, without conclusion, without the slightest impulse to course correct?
I think then you can attend to what is, and so you can actually be more clear about what is.
Which,
if you're not busy avoiding.
Which, from your earlier comments, would suggest nothing is.
Well, I was referring to.
Well, it's kind of like
sights and sounds.
It's like, how clear do you want to be?
Yeah, I
right.
Mean, but like I say, you can't verbalize.
Well, the verbalization is not important, really. I mean, being with what is, were something ising. Could mm-hmm. look 100 different ways.
Okay, well, I don't know if I'm getting your meaning, but what I was referring to is sights and sounds and smells and
yes.
feelings.
Okay, sure.
As what is.
Yes.
So.
If that's what is.
Which you could certainly say it's not.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, being with yourself in nature and not in nature, being with someone else in a relaxed mood and an agitated mood, being put upon, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, what is? What is? And the being with what is, you know, I mean, it's certainly a lovely metaphor. Who knows? You know, we may have used it 100 times or maybe never once before. But again, it's funny because being with what is like, I'll pass. You know what I mean?
It's not an option.
If is.
Right.
I
get that, I think.
If is
now,
is, yeah. Yes. Being with what is. Could be a state, could be an enviable or sought-after state, could be where Gary Weber lives or where one gets to on a 9-day, you know, Vipassana retreat, and maybe not.
Oh, what I'm referring to is more of the nature of,
I know.
What appears to appear.
Yes. What appears to appear. And that's just, you know, at the top level. What appears to be appearing to appear, to appear, to appear. I mean, it's an infinite, you know, disappearing act. Disappearing act.
I was just attempting to remark on what I sense is occurs when you're not avoiding.
Yes. Yes. Sure. That's right.
Because that avoiding seems to close down and shut down, let's say, the aperture.
Yes. Avoidance is another right symptom of fixity.
But then let me put this out there.
Yes.
I don't know how to do it again. But so let's say you're keenly aware.
Let's say.
That. There is actually nothing.
Okay.
But you could say there. Like death.
All right.
There's no life. There's nothing.
Okay.
And yet, at the same time, because I don't know if I would quote unquote experience that while simultaneously experience what I'm calling the awareness of what is. I'm not sure.
Right.
Can they both be? I don't know.
Yes. You're not alone.
Because the one is on the side, so I guess it's like the imminent and the eminent.
Yeah, sure. Uh huh.
I wonder if you could sort of be aware of both simultaneously.
Well,
wouldn't be taking sides.
I mean, nothing's. You can only comment about, right, what is or what you think is happening through representational means. Mm-hmm. Even if you're being with what is, so, less deluded than the next guy, that doesn't mean you're actually being with what is, because no one really knows what is.
Okay, I think my confusion comes in. I could be totally wrong. I think my confusion comes in where I might trust sensations as long as there's no narrative.
I hear you. Sure.
So then I might be calling what is lack of narrative.
Yes, and that would be, of course, you know, perfectly reasonable to do.
Well, but maybe not. I don't know.
There is not a ideal destination or an ideal quality of consciousness or awareness or being. Part of the error of the various purifications and practices that one can play around with is the anticipation of, you know, an ideal destination. Maybe Gary Weber living with the cessation of the DMN sounds like an enviable destination, an enviable state or condition. And the projection of there being a final or enviable or total anything drags along with it the notion of your being the observer or the enjoyer of such a enviable or final condition or state. And if we entertain just for fun the absence of any finality or any state, or possibly hope to witness, perceive, gain, or enjoy, then I don't know what the fuck this is. And that would include, I don't know what it means to be with. Not to just be, you know, an asshole about it. Just like, I'm toast.
So perhaps I've gone, let's call it a pendulum swing.
Yeah.
And I've gone and swung over to the, there's nothing, 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 nothing. And now I'm sort of like, that's my new thing.
That's really something.
I've been cursed and spoiled again.
That nothing really has something to it. You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good t-shirt. Curses, foiled again.
It might. Oh, I just don't know.
Now you're drinking what I'm drinking.
Yeah.
Bartender, pour me a double. You know, Krishna walks into a bar, a bartender says, "Why so blue?"
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tough. Because, I mean, if I'm holding on to palpable...
Yes.
Palpable disambiguation, I don't even know.
Palpable disambiguation. That's good.
Wow.
I'm like, good one. Fuck, but I'm holding on to it.
Okay. Good luck. Good luck. Cling for dear life.
Fucked again.
Fucked again. Foiled again. Curses. Foiled again.
That's right.
Palpable disambiguation gets me at every turn.
I guess if we have one, we end up using it. This mind that plays, it searches, it comes up with clever things, and thinks it understands, and then it's totally confused. And it forgets that it's even
bullshit.
A self. I think when it forgets that it's even a self, it's kind of a cool place. Mm-hmm. But again, the commentator has just shown up in 3D.
Yeah, the fact of it is irrefutable. And the commenting upon it, which is fine.
It's all I think.
Is,
over here.
Yeah, you can see it's just not quite so satisfying. Yeah. The fool on the hill, right, says hello to whom? Nobody.
Yep.
Right? Yeah, so... And that's, isn't that how we vacillate? I mean, you know, we move through the day in a, right, vacillating condition. Tasks and to-dos and fucking off and fucking in and making things right and making things worse and how do we occupy our time and keeping our appointments and organizing our thoughts and imagining that we're decisive, in control, clear, keen, on time, when it's really just not that. Abiding is abiding, you could say, because it has no measure. One is not abiding in a place, in a condition, in a state, in a time frame. Abiding is, there is no measure. There's no boundary condition that comes to your assistance or consternation.
So any observable condition that's called enlightenment would be folly.
Yes, it would be folly.
In fact, well, there's no in fact.
Yeah, there is no in fact.
I was just going to say, the sexier it looks, the more elusive, the more deceiving.
Yes.
You know, the one that makes a lot of money and people gaga at. It's like, watch out, you're on drugs, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
And that drug of ego is stronger than any chemical substance.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You're hurting
Well,
me.
You want to be, you don't want to be enlightened. You want to be free. Enlightened is too heavy. Yeah, it's too much. There's too much to have to prove.